Chapter 11. The cemetery lay in the bright sun. Graber saw that a bomb had hit the gate. A few crosses and granite headstones were strewn over the paths and graves. The weeping willows had been turned upside down. As a result, the roots seemed to be branches, and the boughs, long, trailing green roots. They looked like some strange growth that had been thrown up, decked with seaweed from a subterranean sea. Most of the bones from the bomb-wrecked graves had been gathered up and heaped in a tidy pile. Only small splinters and fragments of decaying coffins hung in the willows. No longer any skulls. A shed had been put up beside the chapel. An overseer and his two helpers were at work there. The overseer was sweating. When he heard what Graber wanted, he waved him away.
No time, man. 12 more burials before lunch. Dear God, how should we know whether your parents are here? There are dozens of graves without headstones and without names. This has turned into mass production. How can we know about everybody?
Don't you keep lists?
Lists,
the overseer replied bitterly, turning to the two assistants.
Lists he wants to see. Did you hear that? Lists. Do you know how many corpses are still lying outside? 300. Do you know how many were brought in after the last air raid? 700. How many after the one before? 500. There were just 4 days in between. How are we going to catch up with that? We're not equipped to do it. We need steam shovels instead of grave diggers to handle what's still lying out there. And can you tell me when the next attack is coming? Tonight? Tomorrow? And he wants to have lists.
Graber made no reply. He took a package of cigarettes out of his pocket and laid it on the table. The overseer and his helpers exchanged glances. Graber waited for a moment. Then he laid down 3 cigars as well. He had brought them back from Russia for his father.
Well, all right, the overseer said. We'll see what we can do. Write down the name. One of us will ask at the cemetery office. Meanwhile, you can take a look at the dead that haven't been recorded yet. Those rows over there by the church wall.
Graber went over. Some of the dead bore names. Others had coffins, stretchers, blankets, flowers, shrouds, or were covered with white sheets. He read the names, lifted the sheets over those that were unnamed, and then walked across to the rows of the unknown who lay side by side under a narrow, temporary roof that had been put up against the wall. The eyes of some had been closed. The hands of some had been folded. But most of them lay the way they had been found. Only their arms had been pressed close to their bodies and their legs straightened so they would take up less room. A silent procession was moving past. Bent over, they examined the pale, rigid faces, searching for their own dead. Graber took his place in line. A few steps ahead of him, a woman suddenly sank to the ground beside one of the corpses and began to sob. The rest walked silently around her and proceeded, bent over and with faces so intent they seemed empty, without any expression except anxious expectation. Only as they neared the end of the row, a pale gleam of covert, uneasy hope gradually appeared, and one could see them sigh with relief when they were through. Graber walked back.
Have you been in the chapel yet?
The overseer asked.
No. The badly mutilated ones are there.
The overseer looked at Graber.
It takes strong nerves, but you're a soldier after all.
Graber went into the chapel. Then he came back. The overseer was standing outside.
Horrible, isn't it?
He glanced at Graber searchingly.
Several people have folded up on us looking at them, he went on. Only yesterday a troop leader from the concentration camp, a giant of a fellow.
Graber did not answer. He had seen so many dead that he found nothing out of the ordinary here, not even the fact that here they were civilians, and many of them women and children. He had seen that too, often enough. And the mutilations of the Russians and Dutch and French had been no less hideous than those he now saw. It even seemed to him that the corpses frozen in the Russian winter in every stage of decomposition and dismemberment, and a group of 50 hanged men with bloated heads, burst protruding eyes, split lips and thick black tongues, had been more horrible than these fragments of humanity in the chapel.
There's no record in the cemetery office, the overseer announced. But there are 2 more big mortuaries in the city. Have you been there yet?
Yes.
They still have ice,
the overseer said, almost enviously.
They are better off than we are.
They're overcrowded.
Yes, but they're refrigerated. That's something we don't have, and it's getting warmer and warmer. If a couple more attacks come close together and we have more sunny days on top of that, there'll be a catastrophe. It will mean that we'll have to resort to mass graves.
Graber nodded. He did not consider that a catastrophe. The catastrophe was what caused the mass graves.
We work as hard as we can, the overseer explained. We have as many grave diggers as we can hire, but even so, they're not nearly enough. The procedure here is out of date in this age. Of course, religious requirements are a complication.
He rubbed his forehead worriedly.
The only institutions that are really modern in every respect are the concentration camps. They can dispose of hundreds of corpses a day. All the newest methods. But, of course, they use a crematorium, and that's out of the question for us.
For a moment, he stared out thoughtfully over the wall. Then he waved to Graber briefly and strode rapidly back to his shed, a loyal, conscientious officer of death. Graber had to wait for a few minutes. Two funerals blocked the exit. He looked around once more. Priests were praying over the graves. Relatives were kneeling beside the headstones. There was a smell of faded flowers and fresh earth. Birds were singing. The procession of searchers continued to move along the wall. Gravediggers were swinging their picks in half-dug graves. Stonecutters and undertakers were wandering about. The abode of death had become the busiest spot in the city. Binding's little white house lay in the early twilight of its garden. On the lawn stood a birdbath into which water was splashing. Jonquils and tulips were in bloom in front of the lilac bushes, and under the birch trees stood the marble statue of a girl. The housekeeper opened the door. She was a gray-haired woman, wearing a large white apron.
You are Herr Graber, are you not?
Yes.
The commander is not here. He had to attend an important party meeting, but he left a message for you.
Graber followed her into the house with its antlers and paintings. The Rubens shone of itself in the twilight. On the copper smoking stand stood a bottle already wrapped. Beside it lay a letter. Alphons wrote that he had not been able to find out much so far. But Graber's parents had not been reported as dead or wounded anywhere in the city. Probably they had been evacuated or had moved. Graber could come again tomorrow. The vodka was for him to use tonight to celebrate the fact that he was far from Russia. He put the bottle and the letter into his pocket. Frau Kleinert had remained in the doorway.
The commander sends his warmest greetings.
Give him mine, too. Tell him I'll be back tomorrow. And many thanks for the bottle. I can use it. Frau Kleinert smiled.
He will be pleased. He is such a kind man.
Graber walked back through the garden. A kind man, he thought. But had Alphons been kind to Burmeister, their mathematics teacher, whom he had sent to the concentration camp? Probably everyone was a kind person for somebody, and for somebody else, the opposite. He felt for the note and the bottle. To celebrate, he thought. What? The hope that his parents were not dead? And with whom? With the man in room 48 at the barracks? He stared into the twilight that had grown bluer and deeper. He might take the bottle to Elisabeth Kruse, he thought. She could use it as well as he could. For himself, he still had the Armagnac. The woman with the blurry face opened the door.
I'd like to see Fräulein Kruse, Graber said determinedly and tried to pass her. She did not move from the doorway.
Fräulein Kruse is not in, she replied. You ought to know that.
What do you mean I ought to know that?
Didn't she tell you?
I forgot. When will she be back?
At 7.
Graber had not reckoned on Elisabeth's being out. He debated where to leave the vodka, but who knew what this informer would make of it? Perhaps she would even drink it herself.
All right, I'll come back then, he said.
He stood in the street outside and looked at his watch. It was a little before 6. The evening once more lay long and dark before him.
Don't forget that you're on furlough, Reuter had said. He had not forgotten, but that by itself did not help much.
He went to the Karlsplatz and sat down on a bench in the square. The air raid shelter crouched there massively like a monstrous toad. Cautious people were slipping into it like shadows. Darkness welled up out of the bushes and drowned the last light. Graber sat quietly on the bench. An hour later, he had not thought of seeing Elizabeth again. If he had found her at home, he would probably have given her the vodka and gone away, he thought. But now that he had not found her, he was waiting impatiently for 7 o'clock. Elizabeth opened the door herself.
"I wasn't prepared for you," he said in surprise. "I was expecting the dragon that guards your gate."
"Frau Lisa isn't here. She went to a meeting of the National Socialist Women's Auxiliary."
"The Flatfoot Brigade, of course. That's where she belongs."
Graber looked around.
"The minute she leaves, it looks different here."
"It looks different because now the light is on the vestibule,"
Elizabeth replied.
"I turn it on whenever she leaves."
"And when she's here?"
"When she's here, we're thrifty. That's patriotic. We sit in the dark."
"That checks," Graber said. "That's where they like us to be." He pulled the bottle out of his pocket. "Here's some vodka I brought you. It comes from the cellar of an SA commander, a present from a schoolmate."
Elizabeth looked at him.
"Have you that sort of schoolmate?"
"Yes, just as you have a border you didn't choose." She smiled and took the bottle.
"I must see whether there's a corkscrew anywhere."
She walked ahead of him into the kitchen. He saw that she was wearing a black sweater and a tight black skirt. Her hair was tied together at the nape of her neck with a thick, lustrous band of red wool. She had straight, strong shoulders and narrow hips.
"I can't find a corkscrew," she said, closing the drawers. "Apparently Frau Lieser doesn't drink. She looks as though she did nothing else.
But we don't need a corkscrew."
Graber took the bottle, knocked the varnish off its neck, and struck it twice sharply against his thigh. The cork popped out.
"That's the way we do it in the army," he explained. "Have you glasses, or shall we drink out of the bottle?"
"I have glasses in my room. Come."
Graber followed her. He was suddenly glad that he had come. He had been afraid he would have to spend another evening sitting around by himself. Elizabeth took two thin wine glasses from a break front with books in it that stood against the wall. Graber glanced around. The room looked different today. It contained a bed, a couple of armchairs covered in green, the books, and a Biedermeier desk. Their effect was old-fashioned and peaceful. In his memory, it had been more disorderly and wild. It must have been the noise of the sirens, he thought. Noise confused everything. Elizabeth, too, looked different today from the way she had then. Different, but not old-fashioned and not peaceful. She turned around.
"How long is it really since we saw each other?"
100 years. At that time we were children and there was no war.
"And now?"
"Now we're old without the experience of age. Old and cynical and without faith and sometimes sad. Not often sad." She looked at him.
"Is that true?"
"No. But what is?
Do you know?"
Elizabeth shook her head.
"Does something always have to be true?"
"Probably not."
"Why?"
"I don't know.
But perhaps we'd have fewer wars if everyone wasn't so eager to convince someone else of his own particular truth."
Graber smiled. The way she said it sounded odd.
"Tolerance," he said. "That's what's lacking, isn't it?"
Elizabeth nodded. He took the glasses and filled them. "We'll drink to that. The commander who gave me this bottle certainly didn't have anything like that in mind. But we'll do it for that very reason." He emptied his glass. "Will you have another?" he asked. Elizabeth shook herself briefly.
"Yes,"
she said then. He poured and placed the bottle on the table. The vodka was sharp and clear and clean. Elizabeth put her glass down.
"Come," she said. "I'll show you an example of tolerance."
She led him through the vestibule and pushed open a door.
"In her hurry, Frau Lieser forgot to lock up. Take a look at her room. It's no betrayal of confidence. She searches mine all the time when I'm out."
Part of the room was furnished in the ordinary way. But on the wall opposite the window, in a massive frame, hung a large colored portrait of Hitler, decked with wreaths of evergreen and oak leaves. On a table under it, a deluxe edition of Mein Kampf, bound in black leather and stamped with a gold swastika, lay on top of a huge swastika flag. On either side stood silver candlesticks with photographs of the Führer beside them, one with his sheepdog in Berchtesgaden, and another that showed a little girl in a white dress handing him flowers. Honor daggers and party badges completed the exhibit. Graeber was not especially surprised. He had often seen similar things. The cult of a dictator easily turned into a religion. "Does she write her denunciations here?" he asked.
"No, she writes them over there, at my father's desk."
Graeber looked at the desk. It was old-fashioned, with a high back and a roll top.
"It's always locked," Elisabeth said. "You can't get into it. I've tried several times."
"Did she denounce your father?"
"I don't know for sure. She was already living here with her child at that time. She had only one room. After my father was taken away, she got the two that belonged to him as well."
Graeber turned toward her. "Do you mean she might have done it for that reason?"
"Why not? It often takes even less reason than that."
"That's true. But from the altar here, it looks as though the woman is one of the crazy fanatics of the Flatfoot Brigade."
"Ernst," Elisabeth said bitterly, "do you really believe that fanaticism can never go hand in hand with personal advantage?"
"No. As a matter of fact, it often does. Strange that one keeps forgetting that. There are platitudes you learn somewhere or other and go on using without thinking about them. The world is not divided into compartments with labels, and human beings even less. Very likely this poisonous reptile loves her child, her husband, flowers, and everything noble in existence. Did she know something against your father, or did she invent the whole thing?"
"My father was good-natured and careless and had been under suspicion for a long time. Not everyone can keep quiet when he has to listen to party speeches all day long in his own home."
"Do you know what he might have said?"
Elisabeth shrugged her shoulders. "He didn't believe that Germany would win the war."
"There are many now who do not believe that."
"You too?"
"I too."
"And now let's get out of here. Otherwise that she-devil will catch you, and who knows what she'll do then."
Elisabeth gave a quick smile.
"She won't catch us. I bolted the door to the corridor. She can't get in."
She went to the door and pushed back the bolt.
"Thank God," Graeber thought. "Even if she is a martyr, at least she plays the part cautiously and without many scruples." "It smells like a cemetery here," he said. "It must be those damn wilted oak leaves.
Come, let's have something to drink." He filled the glasses. "Now I know why we feel old," he said. "It's because we've seen too much filth. Filth stirred up by people who are older than we and ought to be wiser."
"I don't feel old," Elisabeth replied.
He looked at her. She looked anything but old. "Be glad of it," he answered.
"I feel imprisoned," she said. "That's worse than feeling old."
Graeber sat down in one of the Biedermeier chairs. "Who can be sure that woman won't denounce you too?" he said. "Perhaps she wants the whole apartment for herself. Why do you wait for that to happen? There's no justice for you, you know that."
"Yes, I know that."
Elisabeth suddenly appeared headstrong and helpless.
"It's like a superstition,"
she replied hurriedly and tormentedly, like someone who has given herself the same answer 100 times.
"As long as I'm here, I believe that my father will come back. If I went away, it would be like abandoning him. Do you understand that?"
"One doesn't have to understand it. One acts on it, and that's the end of it, even if it's unreasonable."
"Good."
She picked up her glass and emptied it. Outside, there was the rattling of a key. "There she is," Graeber said. "That was close. The meeting doesn't seem to have lasted long." They listened to the steps in the vestibule. Graeber glanced at the gramophone. "Haven't you anything but marches?" he asked.
"Yes, but marches are loud, and sometimes when the silence screams, you have to drown it out with the loudest thing you have."
Graeber looked at her.
"Nice conversations we have.
At school they used to tell us that youth was the romantic time of life." Elisabeth laughed. In the vestibule, something fell on the floor. Frau Lisa swore. Then the door slammed.
"I left the light on," Elisabeth whispered. "Come, Let's get out of here. Sometimes I just can't stand it. And let's talk about something else.
Where shall we go? Graber asked when they were outside.
I don't know. Anywhere.
Isn't there a cafe in the neighborhood, or a tavern, or a bar?
I don't want to go indoors again right away. Let's just walk.
Good.
The streets were empty, and the city was dark and quiet. They walked along Marienstrasse, across Karlsplatz, and then over the river into the old city. After a while, it became unreal, as though all life had vanished and they were the last human beings. They walked past houses and apartment buildings, but when they peered into the windows in the hopes of seeing rooms with chairs, tables, evidence of life, they saw nothing but the reflection of the moonlight in the panes, and behind them the black curtains or the paper coverings of blackout screens. It was as though the whole city were in mourning, an endless morgue shrouded in black with coffined homes, a single wake.
What's going on? Graber asked. Where is everyone? Tonight it's even quieter than usual.
Probably they're sitting in their homes. We haven't had a raid for a couple of days, so they don't dare come out now. They're waiting for the next one. It's always that way. It's only directly after a raid that there are more people out in the streets.
There's already a routine even about that, eh?
Yes. Isn't it the same with you at the front?
Yes.
They walked through a street that lay in ruins. Shreds of cloud drifted across the sky, making the light tremulous. In the ruins, shadows darted out and withdrew like moon-shy sea monsters. Then they heard the tinkle of china.
Thank God, Graber said. There's someone eating or drinking coffee. Anyway, alive.
Probably they're drinking coffee. They distributed some today. Good, as a matter of fact.
Bomb coffee.
Bomb coffee?
Yes, bomb coffee or ruins coffee. That's what they call it. It's an extra ration that's issued after heavy bombings. Sometimes there's sugar, too, or chocolate, or a package of cigarettes.
That's the way it is in the field. There you get schnapps or tobacco before an offensive. Rather ridiculous, isn't it? 200 grams of coffee for 1 hour's fear of death.
100 grams.
They walked on.
After a while, Graber stopped. Elizabeth, this is even grimmer than sitting at home. Let's go somewhere and have a drink. I should have brought along the vodka. I need a schnapps. You too. Where's a place around here?
I don't want to go to a bar. You feel as shut in there as though you were in a cellar. Everything's blacked out and all the windows are covered.
Then let's walk up to the barracks. I still have a bottle there. I'll fetch it and we can have a drink in the open.
Good.
Through the stillness, they heard the rattling of a wagon. Almost immediately, they saw a horse galloping toward them. Restive, shying at the shadows, its wild eyes and distended nostrils gave it a ghostly look in the pale light. The driver was pulling on the reins. The horse reared. Foam flew from its mouth. They had to climb onto the ruins at the side of the street to let it by. With a swift movement, Elizabeth sprang just high enough to let the horse pass without touching her. She bent over, and for a moment it looked as though she were about to swing herself onto the snorting animal and gallop away. Then she was once more standing alone against the empty expanse of the disordered sky.
You look as though you were going to jump on his back and ride away, Graber said.
If one only could. But where to? The war is everywhere.
That's true. Everywhere. Even in the countries of perpetual peace, in the South Seas and in the Indies. We couldn't escape it anywhere.
They came to the barracks.
Wait here, Elizabeth. I'll get the schnapps. It won't take long.
Graber walked across the barracks courtyard and up the echoing steps to room 48. The place was shaking with the snores of half its inmates. Above the table, a shaded light was burning. The card players were still up. Reuter was sitting beside them, reading.
Where's Butcher? Graber asked.
Reuter closed his book with a bang.
He left word for you that he had found nothing. He ran his bicycle into a wall and broke it. It's the old story. Misfortune breeds misfortune. Tomorrow he's got to go off on foot again, and so tonight he's sitting in a tavern consoling himself. What's happened to you? You look a little pale around the gills.
Nothing. I'm going out again right away. Just wanted to get something.
Graber felt around in his knapsack. He had brought a bottle of Geneva and a bottle of cognac from Russia.
In addition, he still had Binding's Armagnac.
Take the cognac or the Armagnac, Reuters said. The vodka isn't there anymore.
How come?
We drank it. You might have donated it voluntarily. Anyone who comes from Russia had no business acting like a capitalist. He ought to have some consideration for his comrades. It was good vodka.
Graber got out the two bottles that were still there. He put the Armagnac in his pocket and gave the Geneva to Reuter.
You're right. Here, take this as medicine for your gout. And don't act like a capitalist yourself. Give the others some.
Merci.
Reuter hobbled to his locker and got out a corkscrew.
I assume you're planning the most primitive form of seduction, he said. Seduction with the aid of intoxicating beverages. In such cases, one usually forgets to draw the cork beforehand. With a broken neck bottle, it's awfully easy to slash your mugged ribbons in the excitement. Here, be a man of foresight.
Go to hell. The bottle's open.
Reuter opened the Geneva.
How did you come to get Holland gin in Russia?
I bought it. Any more questions?
Reuter grinned.
None. Run along with your Armagnac, you primitive Casanova. And don't be ashamed. There are mitigating circumstances. Lack of time. Leave is short and war is long.
Feldman sat up in bed.
Do you need anything, Graber? There are some things in my wallet. I don't need them. He who sleeps doesn't get syphilis.
That's not so certain, Reuter remarked. There's said to be a kind of Simon Pure infection. But our Graber here is a nature boy, an Aryan stud with 12 thoroughbred ancestors. In a case like his, prophylactics are a crime against the fatherland.
Graber opened the Armagnac, took a swallow, and put it back in his pocket. You're all damned romantics, he said. Why don't you worry about your own affairs?
Reuter dismissed him with a wave of his hand.
Go in peace, my son. Forget the manual of arms and try to be a human being. It's easier to die than to live, especially for one of you, the heroic youth and flower of the nation.
Graber put a package of cigarettes and a tumbler in his pocket.
On his way out, he saw that Rummel was still winning at the card player's table. A pile of money lay in front of him. His face was expressionless, but now he was sweating in bright drops. The barrack stairs were deserted. It was after taps. The corridors re-echoed to Graber's steps. He walked across the wide square. Elizabeth was no longer at the gate.
She's gone away, he thought.
He had almost expected it. Why should she wait for him anyway?
The lady's standing over there, the sentry said. How does a doe-foot like you come to have a girl like that?
That is something for officers. Graber saw Elizabeth now. She was leaning against the wall. He tapped the sentry on the shoulder.
It's a new regulation, my son. You get that instead of a medal when you've been at the front for 4 years. All generals' daughters. Better hurry up and report for frontline service right away, you mooncalf. Don't you know you're not allowed to talk on duty?
He walked across to Elizabeth.
Mooncalf yourself, said the sentry lamely from behind.
They found a bench on a rise behind the barracks. It stood between a pair of chestnut trees, and from it one could look out over the whole city. No light showed anywhere. Only the river glinted in the moon. Graber opened the bottle and filled the tumbler halfway. The Armagnac shimmered in it like liquid amber. He offered it to Elizabeth. Drink it down, he said. She took a swallow and gave the glass back. Drink it down, he said. This is an evening for it. Drink to anything you want, to this damnable life of ours, or to the fact that we're still alive. But drink it. We need it after the dead city. Today we seem to need it badly.
All right. To all of that together.
He refilled the glass and drank himself. He felt the warmth at once. He felt, too, how empty he was. He had not known that. It was an emptiness without pain. He filled the glass once more, halfway, and drank about half of it. Then he placed it between himself and Elizabeth. She was sitting on the bench with her legs drawn up and her arms around her knees. The young foliage of the chestnut trees above her shimmered almost white in the moon, as though a swarm of early butterflies had alighted there.
How black it is, she said, pointing toward the city. Like a burned-out coal mine.
Don't look at it. Turn around. It's different there. The bench stood at the top of the rise, and the hill sloped gradually down on the other side. To fields, moonlit roads, poplar-bordered lanes, the steeple of a village church, and then to the forest and to the blue mountains on the horizon. You see? There is all the peace in the world, Graber said. Simple, isn't it? Simple if you can do it. Just turn around and not think of the other.
One learns that fast enough.
Have you learned it?
Of course, Graber said. Otherwise I wouldn't be alive now.
I wish I could learn it too.
He laughed. You know it already. Life takes care of that. It draws its reserves from any source, and in danger it knows neither weakness nor sentimentality. He pushed the glass toward her.
Is this part of it too? She asked.
Yes, he said. Tonight, for sure. She drank and he watched her.
For a change, he said, let's not talk about the war anymore for a while.
Elizabeth leaned back.
Let's sit quietly and not talk about anything at all.
All right.
They sat in silence. It was very still, and slowly the stillness became animated with the peaceful sounds of the night that did not disturb it but only made it deeper. The soft wind that was like the breathing of the forests, the cry of an owl, the rustling of the grass, and the unending play of cloud and light. The stillness increased in strength. It rose and surrounded them and filtered into them more and more with each breath, and breath itself turned into stillness. It canceled and dissolved and became softer and more prolonged, and was no longer an enemy, but a far-off, beneficent sleep. Elizabeth moved. Graber started up and looked around.
What do you think of that? I went to sleep.
So did I.
She opened her eyes.
The dispersed light was caught in them and made them very transparent.
I haven't slept like this in a long time, she said in astonishment. Always only with the light on and in fear of the darkness and awakening with the shock of terror.
Graber sat in silence. He did not question her. Curiosity dies in times of constant happenings. He only marveled vaguely that he himself was sitting there so calmly, hung with translucent sleep like an underwater rock with waving seaweed. He felt relaxed for the first time since his journey out of Russia. A gentle calm had invaded him like a flood that had risen overnight, whose shining surface seemed suddenly to unite parched and arid regions into a single whole again. They walked down to the city. The streets engulfed them once more. The cold stench of old fires drew about them, and the blank black windows accompanied them again like a procession of catafalques. Elizabeth shivered.
Once upon a time, the houses and streets were full of light. We were so used to it that we thought nothing of it. Today we're beginning to understand what we have lost.
Graber looked up. The sky was clear and cloudless. It was a good night for flyers, and so for his taste, too bright. They say it's this way almost everywhere in Europe, he said. Only Switzerland is supposed to be still full of light at night. They keep the lights burning there so that flyers will see it's a neutral country. A man who was in France and Italy with his squadron told me that. He said Switzerland was like an island of light and peace, for one means the other. Beyond it and around it, as though covered by endless funeral palls, lie the dark countries, Germany, France, Italy, the Balkans, Austria, and the rest that are at war.
Light was given to us and it made human beings of us, Elizabeth said vehemently. But we have murdered it and become cavemen again.
Did it make human beings of us?
Graber wondered.
That seemed to him exaggerated, but maybe Elizabeth was right.
Animals had no light, no light and no fire, and no bombs.
They were standing in Marienstrasse. Suddenly Graber saw that Elizabeth was weeping.
Don't look at me, she said. I ought not to have anything to drink. I just can't drink. I'm not sad. It's only that all at once everything seems to come loose.
Let it be as loose as it likes and don't bother about it. I'm feeling that way too. It's all part of it.
Of what?
of what we were talking about before, of turning around and looking in the other direction. But tomorrow evening, we're not going to run about in the streets. We're going somewhere where there's as much light as this city has to offer. I'll find out about that. You can find gayer company for that than mine. I don't need gay company.
What then?
No gay company. I couldn't stand it. Nor the other sort either, the compassionate kind. I get enough of that during the day. The false and the true. You must have known that yourself. Elizabeth was no longer weeping.
Yes, she said. I've known that myself.
With us, it's different. We don't have to make any pretenses. That's a lot in itself. And tomorrow evening, we're going to the brightest spot in town, and we're going to dine and drink wine and for one evening forget this whole damnable existence. She looked at him.
Is that part of it?
Yes, that's part of it. Put on the brightest dress you have.
All right. Come at 8.
He suddenly felt her hair on his face, and then her lips. It was swift as a breeze, and she had disappeared into the house before he fully knew what it was. He felt for the bottle in his pocket. It was empty. He put it down in front of the house next door. One more day gone, he thought. It's a good thing Reuter and Feltmann can't see me now. What wouldn't they say?